Hello, welcome back to Switching Hats, the careers podcast for researchers who are keen to look beyond the ivory tower for the career. Today, with me, Linus Bielinski.
And me, Thomas Nickel. Last time we spoke with Holly Reeve about starting a startup, and she told us all about her journey from academic research to being a CEO. This time, we're going to return to our discussion with Holly, and we wanted to get some insight on what it's like to sit on the other side of the table, not literally the table that we're sitting on right now, but rather what it's like to recruit PhD people to work with you. So to kick things off, when you're recruiting people, what are the advantages to your business of hiring individuals that do have PhDs?
I think the really big advantage is that if you're hiring a scientist from a PhD, you already know that they love being in the lab and that they fully understand what being in a lab environment means. And they typically have a really good understanding of like the rigor involved in planning experiments. And, you know, they know what the day-to-day is going to look like. They understand the safety aspects. They understand there's going to be reporting. They understand, you know, they understand what a day in a lab is going to look like much, much better, perhaps, than someone coming from a master's or an undergrad project. And compared to someone coming from industry, I guess they still have typically that kind of high innovation focus. So they're curious, they're looking to always improve. That can be a double-edged sword, but you know, they have that mindset of, can we make this better?
And mentioning the skills of PhDs, is it then purely focused on R&D work that you recruit PhD for because they have this innovative mindset that you mentioned, or would you also recruit them for less lab-based roles at all?
So typically, if we're thinking about writing a job description, if it were for a lab-based role, I don't think we ever stipulate someone needs to have a PhD, but it's kind of, we would kind of, well, depending on the level of the role, we'd either want PhD or industry lab-based experience. For our less lab-based roles, we typically don't declare whether we don't mind if someone has a PhD or not. Those people will have different experiences and different strengths and weaknesses. But we don't, you know, if your role does not need a PhD, then we don't require you to have a PhD. Does that make sense?
Do you consider a PhD to be an advantage in many roles outside of the lab?
I think that's a really complicated question to answer. So people coming from PhDs, and I did a PhD, obviously, so I see this and I live it and breathe it. How you behave and act and think is so, so changeable based on what group you were in and what university you were in. So I would say when I am recruiting PhDs, the science skills is kind of a given. Like, obviously we test it, but my real concern is like, what group did you come from? How did that group work? And how did you feel about that? Because that's way more important to me. And I've seen really toxic groups, and obviously there's some really awesome people in there, but typically they're the people that didn't like how it ran. Do you know what I mean? So I think people come from PhDs, I know they're going to be able to do what I need them to do, but I don't know if they're going to fit into our culture and our team. And we've had some really big team-wide discussions when we've onboarded a lot of PhD students, people straight out of PhDs quickly, where we've had to literally sit down and talk about how a startup is different to university research. And I think there's some really big topics that come out of that. So, you know, the company may change its strategy really fast. We might have a call with a customer who highlights a problem that we'd never even thought of. And it might be literally, okay, everyone, you need to down tools and swap. You need to focus on this now. I don't even know if we're going to come back to that. If we are going to come back to that, I don't know when. I'm always really clear. I'm always really transparent with why we're making decisions. But, you know, people fundamentally can't get tied to their project and think of it like a little PhD, you know. We are doing things to progress the company. But the flip side of that is that, you know, one of my really senior scientists said to the team the other day, when I was in the university and someone more junior asked for help, I felt like I was stopping my progress for the day to aid their progress for the day. And in the company, when I help someone of a day, I feel like we've moved the whole company forwards and that the whole team is now more productive and more skilled. So we want, you know, yes, a PhD can train you for that, but not all PhDs train you for that. That is the group that you were in.
Yeah, I've definitely can understand where you're coming from. That I've experienced either first or second hand those exact situations, and I've always preferred working in the more collaborative, push the whole group forward environment. So it's nice to see that that translates well to a non-academic situation. So with that in mind, how many staff do you actually have that have PhDs at the moment? I mean, obviously I'm not expecting you to know exact numbers, but ballpark?
I think we, of the team, we are 13. I think there's maybe 10 that are kind of mostly lab-based. I think 3 don't have PhDs and 7 do have PhDs at the moment.
Okay.
And that was not a purposeful decision. Like when we put out job adverts, I think perhaps the skills that we're asking for are quite hard to acquire because it's very interdisciplinary. I don't think undergraduate courses train you particularly efficiently, a lot of them, in the kind of sections of science that we're interested in. So it's more people that have gone on to a PhD and focused in on that area.
So we've mentioned skills, and obviously you're in a very specific niche that you're looking for those skills to fit into. You've obviously got some particular skills that are useful to you, but are there other skills, the softer skills that you would look for as well? And do you think in a more startup-wide situation, not specifically your environment, that these are skills that people look for broadly?
I can't necessarily talk for all startups. So when I'm hiring people, yeah, I am 100% focused on soft skills, I think. Not 100%, but I'm really focused on soft skills. So we, as a team, what we value is honesty and transparency. So if someone can't talk to me about things that have gone bad in their career, then I find it hard to believe that they're honest, because not science doesn't always go to plan all the time. So we really look for that kind of humility, that ability to kind of, you know, if we don't trust our team to come forward on a bad day and tell us that things have gone wrong, then we can't have them in the lab. We need people to 100% believe in safety. We need people to be able to speak up if they see something that's not right or that could be done better. We need people to want to learn and want to teach. We want, you know, if we have someone in our team who knows something that we don't know and they don't find a way to tell us, then we're just missing information. So you can hire the smartest person in the room, but if they can't and won't tell you when you're doing things that could be better, you know, I mean, our head of biology and head of chemistry, you know, they're very clear, like, we studied much longer ago than you guys, you know, new stuff, you've got to challenge what we're doing. Sometimes we might be doing this because this was the way it was done when we learned. There probably are better ways now. It's your, you know, it's your guys' job to come tell us that. So we need people that can understand that, you know, yeah, okay, there's some kind of hierarchy and, you know, decision making has to happen in a certain way, but equally, there's always a place for people to kind of healthily challenge that.
Do you think as the company grows, that will be harder to maintain that
culture?
That culture where people feel free coming up and being like, no, you're doing this wrong. I learned last week in chemistry class that we're doing it this way now.
I mean, I've got to imagine that when we're 100 people, the most junior hire is not going to march into my office and tell me I'm doing it wrong. But I'd like to think that they would tell their line manager. Okay. I think, you know, it will... I think obviously we talk a lot as a leadership team about how we keep culture as we grow. And it is hard because every new person that joins a team changes the team dynamic and changes how things happen. But I think there's some basic things that we, you know, can't accept, you know what I mean?
That's interesting that you say every new hire changes the team dynamic, even though you have a plan for the way the company goes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it then different depending on whether you hire fresh PhDs or more experienced postdocs in the way they might impact the company? And do you have any preference in general?
I don't have preference. I think when I talk about new hires really changing the team, I mean mostly from a personality, but it's all that other stuff, that diversity of how people think, how people behave. You know, when we first started, we were a really small team, and it just so happened that we were all pretty extroverted and chatty and said what we were thinking. And, you know, as we grew, obviously we started to hire people that were a bit more introverted, and that just changes really random things like how your offices are laid out, what kind of activities you do to bond. Like, I think it's all that other stuff, like how, you know, and I see it in academic groups as they grow, the ways that they bring people together should change, and they don't always. So, you know, if you're a group of five and you love to go to the pub on a Wednesday night, great. But as you introduce parents or people that don't drink or people that want to go home or whatever, like, how do you keep that inclusivity? Yeah.
So it's more a case of adapting to the workforce you hire. You don't have a specific preference for a certain personality type.
We need every single personality type. So we just did a big diversity as an advantage training course as a company, where we sat down with a leadership coach. It's dangerous to do this by yourself. And she was like, they were like, what, you know, for each person, like, what do you think you are different on? Like, do you feel like the quietest person in the room? Do you feel like the most detail-oriented person in the room? And we thought about what the opposite side of that might look like. And then we all lined ourselves up, and then we kind of saw where people would put themselves. Like, one of the really stupid ones was like, I'm fun at work and I'm serious at work. And then people lining up and seeing, it was really interesting to see where people put themselves, which actually other people couldn't predict. And then they'd make us swap ends and be like, well, what would your life look like at work if you were on the other end of this spectrum? And it really challenged people in a really, really healthy way to value other people and to value that, you know, other people working different ways is beneficial and good, and this is what it can bring. And actually, maybe I should spend some time over here and encourage them to spend some time over there. We need everybody. We need the deep thinkers. We need the quick actors. We need all those natural kind of predispositions. And then we need to bring them together so that as a team, you know, we're doing things at the right level.
As Tom mentioned, when the company grows and you have this huge diversity of people that you then need to bring together, is this in any way different at the very beginning than when you do your first hires, when the startup is launched, that you then look for more extroverted people or a certain personality, or it just happens that it's often this certain type of person that you would be looking for? Or?
I think that was just chance. And I want to be really clear, we do not hire based on personality types. What I'm trying to say is we have lots of different personality types, and we work really hard to value them all and to help the whole team value them all. We hire for skills. We might hire slightly differently as company grows when we move from more R&D to more commercial. And when you're going from that more exploratory phase to that more, we call it exploratory and exploitation, as in the kind of activities the company has to do in the lab might change. But yeah, we don't hire... Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like we hire for personality. That is absolutely not fair. But we do hire for things like honesty, transparency, respectful communication, and things like that.
When you're advertising a job, are you advertising through normal channels? Are you going on Indeed and Jobs AC UK? Or are you looking through your existing channels, your existing networks for people you think, oh, that person might be suitable. We have a job coming up. Let's put them in the line. Yep. So is it still a case of a lot of jobs I've had in the past have been a case of who I knew, not what I knew. Is that still a thing when you get to this startup and in very science-focused work?
I think it definitely can be, especially when you're hiring really fast-paced. So we put all our jobs on LinkedIn. We kind of go to events, conferences, whatever, and we go to conferences targeted at the areas that we're trying to recruit from. We do sometimes, I don't think we're allowed to put them on jobs.ac.uk because we're not a university, but we have tried putting jobs on like Indeed and on things like that in the past, but we don't find it typically gets us the right applicants. I'd say a huge amount of our job advertisement goes on through LinkedIn and then through networks. So we might email to the university, for example, and be like, can you share this with your chemistry teams? But then we do get it the other way around. We meet or introduce to great people and we're like, do you know what? I think we could really use that skill set. Like, is this a skill that we can afford to hire right now? Is it a good time for us? Our investors are really clear, like, if you find great people, hire them, even if it's not in the plan, because great people are really hard to come by. So yeah, if we meet someone who's really great as a person and has the right, you know, ambition and culture and everything else and the right and a skill set that we don't currently have, then we'll probably try and find a way to have them. Not always, obviously, but
I was going to say, even if they're not in the right field.
Well, but... no.
So then, from what you're saying, it sounds there's a lot of truth to the just get to know people, put yourself out there, and then maybe a job will be created for you if you find that company where they think, oh, that you're exactly the type of staff we need at the moment. So that's kind of the direction it goes in.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, sometimes you don't know you need someone until someone convinces you need them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we do it both ways around, and both ways around have been really successful for us. So there's nothing like meeting someone in person, though, to really, you know, I've met people at conferences, for example, who have literally emailed me and been like, I just saw you advertise a job in the last presentation. Can you like come grab coffee with me right now? Like, this is someone who's really interested, you know.
So what can people do to set themselves out during that? So say I find a job on LinkedIn. You're advertising, I want to apply for it. How can I set myself apart both during that application and an interview process? Obviously, you've said the things about being the right kind of person. I can't change my personality.
Not personality, the right kind of values. We've got to, I need to go back and re-edit this. It's the values of a person, not the personality that matters.
Put a note in there to edit this out.
So I had a really big mantra on this while I was in the university, okay? Your science is, let's take it as a given. You're a great scientist. You're doing a PhD, you know, whatever. What else are you bringing to the research environment that makes you great? And you often can't see this for yourself, because if you find something easy and you're good at it, you probably don't notice you're doing it. So the thing you can do is go tell other people what they're doing that makes your life easier. Are they really good at like explaining something complicated simply? Are they really good at actually going out and talking to other people and finding new information that drives your research in better directions? Are they just really good at making sure the lab is functioning, that everything is there? Like, you have definitely, everybody has these skills that they are bringing to a productive research environment. If you can identify those, you're going to make yourself stand out better. So, for example, I always loved talking. I think we get that, and communicating. But I was told so many times that scientists aren't good communicators. And I got so frustrated that I applied for a media fellowship and went and worked at the Mirror for a couple of weeks. And then I could put it on my CV. And my intention was like, I will find something I can put on my CV that says I can communicate. Now, obviously, going to the Mirror and working there for a couple of weeks, I learned loads and I got way better. But that wasn't my intention. My intention was, stop telling me I can't do this. I think I can do this. I will prove to you that I can do this. So, you know, identify those things that you're really good at and then go get training in them. Get better at them. Put something on your CV that says that you're doing them. It doesn't matter what it is. Networking, communicating, project management, leadership, finances, you know, budgeting. I don't care. There is something about you that you can bring to this team that not everybody else can bring to this team.
How important in that sense do you think are the formal qualifications and saying, like having a certificate saying I can do this thing versus getting a little bit of experience, even if it's only a week or so in an industry setting or working with the Mirror or something else? What's the sort of balance between the two of those things?
I think it's really hard, but as everyone says, you know, you see a lot of CVs. The first thing we look at is, have they got the right lab-based skills? You know, if the things you've done in the lab are not hitting the things we want. You know, we don't want to train people from scratch. We don't have time for that. We expect to have to train people in something because what we're doing is different to what other people are doing. But, you know, we don't want to teach you to weigh stuff and make buffer and talk nicely to cells when you grow them, you know. But after that, it's stuff that piques your interest, isn't it? Oh, look, they've taken themselves out of their normal day-to-day and put themselves in a whole new environment, and they want to tell us about it because they believe it's valuable.
Okay. Anything else?
No, that was really insightful.
I have one more thing.
Shoot.
Okay, so I did do a lot of this stuff. I did loads of training in my PhD. And people always ask me one thing. How did you find the time to do it? And I'm like, you can't make more time. You have to believe that doing these training things are good for you. And that if they're good for you, they will be good for your research. And you have to use your allocated time to do them. Like, you have to take it out of the time you already have available. You can't make more time. But if you believe that it's going to be valuable to you, to your research, to your career, you know, just do it.
I know there's been some discussion about how much postdocs should be given time to do career progression and things like that. And apparently there is time allotted in our contracts, but
yes,
not
there is, because
available.
I fought for that 10 days.
Yes. So yes, be aware that there is time in your contracts to allow you to do career progression. But thank you very much, Holly. I think that covers us for this session, and that's been really insightful. I've really enjoyed our discussion.
Yeah, that was very interesting, especially your point about identifying your skill set and build on those. Don't make yourself into a different person just to fit a certain role. And who knows, maybe
I'm glad we finished in the right place. That's yeah. Don't change yourself.
The message came across after three attempts.